This is Audible.
The Missing Ones, an absolutely gripping thriller with a jaw-dropping twist. Written by Patricia Gibney, narrated by Michelle Moran. Prologue, 31st of January 1976. The hole they dug was not deep, less than 3 feet. A milky white flower bag encased the little body, firmly tied with the string of a soiled, once white apron. They rolled the bag along the ground, even though it was light enough to lift. Reverence for the deceased was absent as one of them kicked it into the middle of the hole, squeezing it further into the earth with the sole of his boot. No prayers were said, no final blessing. Just the shoveling of damp clay quickly covering the whiteness with darkness, like night descending without twilight. Beneath the apple tree, which would spout white buds in spring and deliver a flourishing crop in summer, there now rested two mounds of earth, one compacted and solid, the other fresh and loose. Three small faces watched from the third floor window, eyes black with terror. They knelt on one of their beds, cushioned with rough feathered pillows. As the people below picked up their tools and turned away, the three continued to look at the apple tree, now highlighted by the crescent of the moon. They had witnessed something their young brains could not comprehend. They shivered, but not from the cold. The child in the middle spoke without turning his head. "I wonder which one of us will be next." Day 1, 30th of December 2014. Chapter 1. Susan Sullivan was on her way to meet the one person she was most scared of. A walk, yes, a walk would do her good. Out into the daylight, away from the suffocation of her house, away from her own tumbling thoughts. She pushed in her iPod earphones, pulled on a dark woolly hat, tightened her brown tweed coat and faced into the biting snow. Her mind raced. Who was she kidding? She couldn't distract herself, couldn't escape the nightmare of her past. It haunted every waking minute of her day and invaded her night like a bat, black and swift, making her ill. She had tried to make contact with the detective in Ragmullen Garda Station, but had received no reply. It would have been her safety net. More than anything, she wanted to learn the truth. And when she had exhausted all the usual channels, she decided to go it alone. Perhaps it would help her exorcise the demons. She shivered. Walking faster, slipping and sliding, not caring anymore, she had to know. It was time. With her head bent low into the breeze, she trudged through the town as quickly as the frozen footpaths would allow. She looked up at the twin spires of the cathedral as she entered through the wrought iron gates and automatically blessed herself. Someone had thrown handfuls of salt on the concrete steps and it crunched beneath her boots. The snow eased, and a low wintry sun glinted from behind dark clouds. She pushed open the large door, stamped her numb feet on the rubber mat, and, as the echoing of the closing door muted, she stepped into the silence. Removing the earphones, she left them dangling on her shoulders. Though she had walked for half an hour, she was freezing. The east wind had cut through the layers of clothing and her scant body fat could not protect her 51-year-old bones. Rubbing her face, she streaked a finger around her sunken eyes and blinked away the water streaming from them. She tried to refocus in the semi-darkness. Candles on the side altar illuminated shadows along the mosaic walls. Weak sunlight petered through the stained glass windows high above the stations of the cross, and Susan walked slowly through the sepia haze, sniffing the aroma of incense in the air. Bowing her head, she sidled into the front row, the wooden kneeler jolting her joints. She blessed herself again, wondering how she still had a modicum of religion after all that she'd done, all she'd been through. Feeling alone in the silence, She thought how ironic it was that he had suggested meeting in the cathedral. She had agreed, because she believed there would be plenty of people around that time of day, safe. But it was empty. The weather had kept them away. A door opened and closed, sending a whoosh of wind up the center aisle. Susan knew it was him. Fear numbed her. She couldn't look around. Instead, she stared straight ahead at the candle above the tabernacle until it blurred. Footsteps, slow and determined, echoed up the aisle. The seat behind her creaked as he knelt. A fog of cold air swarmed around her, and his distinctive scent vied with the incense. She raised herself from her kneeling position and sat back. His breath, short, sharp puffs, the only sound she could hear. She felt him, without him having touched her. At once, she knew this was a mistake. He was not here to answer her questions. He would not give her the closure she craved.
"You should have minded your own business."
His voice a harsh whisper. She could not answer. Her breathing quickened, and her heart thumped against her ribs, reverberating in her eardrums. She clenched her fingers into fists, knuckles white underneath thin skin. She wanted to run, to get away, far away. But her energy was spent and she knew it was now her time. Tears threatened at the corners of her eyes. And his hand closed around her throat, gloved fingers tracking a line up and down her loose flesh. Her hand flew up to grab at his, but he swatted her away. His fingers found the iPod cable, and she felt him twisting it, curling it about her neck. She smelled his sour aftershave, and she became totally aware then that she would die without ever knowing the truth. She squirmed on the hard wooden seat and tried to pull away, her hands tearing feverishly at his gloved fingers, only succeeding in causing the cable to cut tighter into her skin. Attempting to gulp breaths, she found she couldn't. Warm liquid burned between her legs as she wet herself. He pulled tighter. Weakened, she dropped her arms. He was too strong. As her life choked away beneath the tightness, in a strange way she welcomed the physical pain over the anguished years of mental affliction. Descending darkness extinguished the flame on the candle as his hand jerked once, then twice. And her body slackened, and all fear eased from her being. Within those last moments of torment, she allowed the shadows to lead her to a place of light and comfort, to a peace she had never experienced with the living. Tiny stars pinpricked her eyes before blackness washed in a wave through her dying body. The cathedral bells chimed 12 times. The man released the pressure and pushed her body to the ground. Another blast of freezing air travelled up the center aisle as he left with speed and in silence. Chapter 2
13, said Detective Inspector Lottie Parker.
12, said Detective Sergeant Mark Boyd.
No, there are 13. See the bottle of vodka behind the Jack Daniels? It's in the wrong place. She counted things. A fetish, Boyd called it. Boredom, Lottie called it. But she knew it was a throwback to her childhood. Unable to cope with the trauma in her early life, she had resorted to counting as a distraction from things and situations she couldn't understand, though now it had just become a habit.
"You need glasses," said Boyd.
34, said Lottie. "Bottom shelf."
"I give up," said Boyd.
"Loser," she laughed. They were sitting at the counter in Danny's bar among the small lunchtime crowd. She felt a little warmth as the coal fire roared up in the wide chimney behind them, taking most of the heat with it. The chef stood at the carvery, stirring a thick skin off the top of the gravy in a tray beside his special of the day, wizened roast beef. Lottie had ordered chicken and ciabatta. Boyd had copied her. A slight Italian girl lounged with her back to them, watching bread brown in a small toaster.
They must be plucking the chickens the time these sandwiches are taken, said Boyd.
You're putting me off my food, said Lottie.
If you had any food to be put off, said Boyd.
Forgotten Christmas decorations twinkled along the top of the bar. A poster, sellotaped to the wall, advertised the weekend's band, Aftermath. Lottie had heard her 16-year-old daughter Chloe mention them. A large ornate mirror proclaimed in white chalk last night's special deal, 3 shots for €10.
I'd give €10 for just one this minute, said Lottie.
Before Boyd could respond, Lottie's phone vibrated on the counter. Superintendent Corrigan's name flashed on the incoming call.
Trouble, Lottie said. The little Italian girl turned round with chicken ciabattas.
Lottie and Boyd were already gone.
Who could want this woman dead?
Superintendent Miles Corrigan asked the detectives standing outside the cathedral.
Obviously someone did, Lottie thought, though she knew well enough not to utter this observation aloud. She was tired, perpetually tired. She hated the cold weather. It made her lethargic. She needed a holiday. Impossible. She was broke. God, but she hated Christmas, and hated the gloomy aftermath even more.
She and Boyd, still hungry, had rushed to the crime scene at Ragmullen's magnificent 1930s cathedral. Superintendent Corrigan briefed them on the icy steps. The station had received a call. A body had been discovered in the cathedral. He immediately swept into action man mode, organising the crime scene cordons. If it proved to be a murder, Lottie knew she was going to have trouble extricating him from the case. As detective inspector for the town of Ragmullen, she should be in charge, not Corrigan. For now, though, she needed to put station politics aside and see what they were dealing with on the ground. Her superintendent spouted instructions. She scrunched her shoulder-length hair into the hood of her jacket and zipped it up without enthusiasm. She eyed Mark Boyd over Corrigan's shoulder, caught him smirking, and ignored him. She hoped it wasn't a murder. Probably a homeless person with hypothermia. It had been so cold recently, she didn't doubt for a minute that some unfortunate had succumbed to the elements. She had noticed the cardboard boxes and rolled-up sleeping bags hugging the corners of shop door nooks. Corrigan finished speaking, a sign for them to get to work. Having navigated her way through the Garda activity at the front door, Lottie strode through the secondary cordon set up in the centre aisle. She ducked under the tape and approached the body. A gaseous smell came from the tweed-coated woman wedged between the front row kneeler and the seat. She noticed an earphone cable round the neck and a mini lake of liquid pooled on the floor. Lottie felt the urge to put a blanket over the body.
For Christ's sake! This is a woman, she wanted to shout. Not an object. Who is she? Why was she here? Who would miss her?
She resisted leaning over and closing the staring eyes. Not her job. Standing in the chilly cathedral, now bathed in bright lights, she ignored Corrigan and made the necessary calls to get the experts on site immediately. She secured the inner area for the scene of the crime officers.
State pathologists on our way, said Corrigan. Should only take her 30 minutes or so, depending on the roads. We'll see how she calls it.
Lottie glanced over at him. He was relishing the prospect of getting stuck into a murder case. She imagined his brain conjuring up a speech for the inevitable press conference. But this was her investigation. He shouldn't even be part of her crime scene. Behind the altar rails, Garda Gillian O'Donoghue stood behind a priest who had his arm around the shoulders of a visibly shaking woman. Lottie made her way through the brass gates and approached them.
Good afternoon. I'm Detective Inspector Lottie Parker. I need to ask you a few questions.
The woman whimpered.
Do you have to do it now? The priest asked.
Lottie thought he might be slightly younger than her. She'd be 44 next June, and she would put him in his late 30s. He looked every inch a priest in his black trousers and his woolly sweater over his shirt with a stiff white collar.
"I won't take long," she said. "This is the best time for me to ask the questions, when things are fresh in your minds."
"I understand," he said. "But we've had a terrible shock, so I'm not sure you'll learn anything worthwhile."
He stood up, extended his hand.
"Father Joe Burke. And this is Mrs. Gavin, who cleans the cathedral."
The firmness of his handshake surprised her. She felt the warmth of his hand in her own. He was tall. She added that to her initial appraisal. His eyes, a deep blue, sparkled with the reflection of the burning candles.
"Mrs. Gavin found the body," he said.
Lottie flipped open the notebook she'd extracted from the inside of her jacket. She usually used her phone, but in this holy place it didn't seem appropriate to whip it out. The cleaner looked up and began to wail.
"Shush, shush,"
Father Burke comforted her, as if she was a child. He sat down and gently rubbed Mrs. Gavin's shoulder.
"This nice detective only wants you to explain what happened."
"Nice," Lottie thought. That's one word she'd never used to describe herself. She eased into the seat in front of the pair and twisted round as much as her padded jacket allowed. Her jeans were eating into her waist. "Jesus," she thought, "I'll have to cut out the junk food." When the cleaner looked up, Lottie surmised that she was aged about 60. Her face was white with shock, enhancing every line and crevice. "Mrs. Gavin, can you recount everything from the moment you entered the cathedral today, please?" Simple enough question, thought Lottie. Not for Mrs. Gavin, who greeted the request with a cry. Lottie noticed Father Burke's look of sympathy, which seemed to say, "I pity you trying to get anything out of Mrs. Gavin today." But as if to prove them both wrong, the distraught woman began to speak, her voice low and quivering.
"I came on duty at 12 to clean up after the 10 o'clock mass. Normally I start to the side," she said, pointing to her right. "But I thought I saw a coat on the floor at the front of the middle aisle, so I said to myself, I better get cracking over there first. That's when I knew it wasn't just a coat. Oh, holy mother of God!"
She blessed herself 3 times and attempted to stem her tears with a crumpled tissue. The Holy Mother of God wasn't going to help any of them now, thought Lottie. "Did you touch the body?"
"God, no, no,"
said Mrs. Gavin.
"Her eyes were open and that thing around her neck. I've seen corpses before, but I've never seen one like that, by Jesus. Sorry, Father. I knew it was a dead person."
"What did you do then?"
"I screamed, dropped me mop and bucket and ran for the sacristy. Collided head first with Father Burke here."
"I heard the scream and rushed out to see what was going on," he said. "Did either of you see anyone else around?"
"Not a soul," said Father Burke.
Fresh tears escaped down Mrs. Gavin's cheeks.
"I can see you're very upset," Lottie said. "Garda O'Donoghue will take your details and arrange for you to get home. We'll be in touch with you later. Try to get some rest."
"I'll look after her, Inspector," Father Burke said. I need to talk to you now?"
"I live in the priest's house behind the cathedral. You can get me there any time."
The cleaner leaned her head into his shoulder.
"I ought to go with Mrs. Gavin," he said.
"Fine," Lottie relented, seeing the distraught woman aging by the second. "I'll be in touch later." Father Burke nodded, and supporting Mrs. Gavin by the arm, he led her across the marble floor towards a door behind the altar. O'Donoghue followed them out. A gust of cold air breezed into the cathedral as the scene of crime officers arrived. Superintendent Corrigan rushed to greet them. Jim McGlynn, head of the SOCO team, offered him a precursory handshake, ignored small talk, and immediately began directing his people. Lottie watched them working for a few minutes, then walked around the pew as close to the body as McGlynn would allow. "Appears to be a middle-aged woman. Wrapped up well for the weather," Lottie said to Boyd,
who was standing at her shoulder like a persistent mole. She moved backwards towards the altar rails, partly to view from a good vantage point, mainly to put distance between her and Boyd.
"Hypothermia is not an issue here, so," he said, stating the obvious to no one in particular.
Lottie shivered as the serenity of the cathedral was decimated by the heightened activity. She continued observing the work of the technical team.
"This cathedral is our worst nightmare," said Jim McGlynn. "God himself knows how many people frequent here every day, each leaving a piece of themselves behind." "The killer picked his location well," Superintendent Corrigan said.
No one answered him. The sound of high heels clipping up the main aisle caused Lottie to look up. The small woman rushing toward them was dwarfed in a black puffer jacket. She jangled car keys in her hand and then, as if remembering where she was, dropped them into the black leather handbag on her arm. She shook hands with the superintendent as he introduced himself.
"State pathologist Jane Doerr."
Her tone was sharp and professional.
"You're acquainted with Detective Inspector Lottie Parker," Corrigan said.
"Yes, I'll be as quick as I can."
The pathologist directed her words to Lottie.
"I'm anxious to get the autopsy underway. As soon as I can declare this one way or the other, the sooner you can officially spring into action."
Lottie was impressed with the way the woman handled Corrigan, putting him in his place before he could start a sermon. Jane Doerr was no more than 5'2" and looked tiny beside Lottie, who stood without heels at 5'8". Today, Lottie wore a pair of comfortable Uggs, jeans tucked untidily inside them. After donning gloves, a white Teflon boiler suit and covering her shoes, the pathologist proceeded to carry out the preliminary examination of the body. She worked her fingers under the woman's neck, examining the cable embedded in her throat, lifting her head and concentrating the examination on her eyes, mouth and head. The Sockos turned the body onto its side and the stench rose in the air. Lottie realized the pool congealed on the floor was urine and excrement. The victim had soiled herself in the last seconds of her life.
"Any idea on time of death?" Lottie asked.
"My initial observation would indicate she died within the last 2 hours. Once I complete the autopsy, I'll confirm that."
Jane Doerr peeled the latex gloves from her petite hands.
"Jim, when you finish up, the body can be removed to the Tullamore mortuary."
Not for the first time, Lottie wished the health services executive hadn't relocated the mortuary services to Tullamore Hospital, half an hour's drive away. Another nail in Ragmullen's coffin.
"As soon as you can declare the cause of death, please inform me immediately," Corrigan said.
Lottie tried not to roll her eyes. It was obvious to everyone that the victim had been strangled. The pathologist only had to officially class the death as murder. There was no way this woman had accidentally or otherwise strangled herself. Jane Doerr dumped her Teflon garments into a paper bag, and as promptly as she had arrived, she left the scene, the echo of her high heels reverberating in her wake.
"I'm heading back to the office," Corrigan said. "Inspector Parker, get your incident team set up immediately."
He marched down the marble floor behind the departing pathologist. The Socco team spent another hour around the victim before expanding their area of operation outwards. The corpse was placed into a body bag, zipped up and lifted onto the waiting gurney with as much dignity as could be attached to a large rubber bag. The wooden door creaked as they exited. The ambulance blasted out its sirens, unnecessarily as its patient was dead and in no hurry to go anywhere. Chapter 3 Lottie pulled up the hood of her jacket and clasped it to her ears. She stood on the snow-covered cathedral steps, leaving behind the hum of activity. Every nook would be searched and every inch of marble inspected. She breathed in the cold air and peered skywards. The first flakes of a snow flurry settled on her nose and melted. The large Midland town of Ragmullen lay still. Beyond the wrought iron gates now swathed in blue and white crime scene tape. Like herself, the once thriving factory town struggled to awake each day. Its inhabitants muddled through the daylight hours until darkness sheathed their windows and they could rest until the next mundane day dawned. Lottie liked the anonymity it offered, but was also aware that her town, like many others, had its share of secrets buried deep. The life in Ragmullen appeared to have died with the economy. Young people were fleeing to Australian and Canadian shores to join those lucky enough to have escaped already. Parents bemoaned the fact of not having enough money for daily essentials, not to mention an iPhone for Christmas. Well, Christmas was over for another year, thought Lottie, and good riddance. The drone of the ring road traffic seemed to shake the ground, though it was 2 kilometres away, which denied retailers a passing trade. She looked up at the trees labouring under the weight of snow-filled branches and scanned the grounds in front of her, knowing instinctively they wouldn't find any evidence. The earth was frozen, and the soft snow hardened as quickly as it fell. The morning mass-goers' footprints were encased under another layer of snow and ice. Garda, clutching long-handled tongs, scoured the grounds for clues. She wished them luck.
14, said Boyd.
The smoke from his freshly lit cigarette clouded around Lottie as he invaded her space. Again, she stepped away. He moved into the spot she'd vacated, his sleeve brushing against hers. Boyd was tall and lean. A hungry-looking man, her mother once said, turning up her nose. His brown, hazel-flecked eyes lit up an interesting face, strong and clear-skinned, with ears that stuck out a little. His short hair was greying quickly. He was 45 and dressed in a spotless white shirt and grey suit beneath his heavy hooded jacket.
14 what? She asked.
Stations of the Cross, Boyd said. I thought you might account to them, so I got in before you.
Get a life,
Lottie said. There was a history between them, and she cringed at her drunken memory, distilled with the passage of time, but still present on the periphery of her consciousness. Other things had come between them, too. She got the inspector job that Boyd had sought. It didn't bother him most of the time, but she knew he'd relished the chance to lead the investigation. Tough shit, Boyd. She was delighted with the promotion, because it meant she didn't have to commute the 60 kilometres to Athlone each day. The year she'd been based there had been a nuisance, though she wasn't sure if being back working with Boyd in Ragmullen was more of a nuisance. But on the plus side, it meant she was no longer dependent on her interfering mother to check in on the children. Boyd childishly blew smoke rings into the air, and she turned away from the smile curving under his inquisitive nose.
You started it, he said.
With one final pull on his cigarette, he went down the steps and headed for the Garda station across the road. Lottie smiled despite herself, and walking carefully, so as not to fall on her arse in front of half the force, she took off after the long, lanky Boyd. A few people were queuing in the reception area. As the duty sergeant tried to keep order, Lottie skipped by and hurried up the stairs to the office. The phones were ringing loudly.
Who said good news travels fast? What about bad news? Travels at the speed of light.
Sniffing the stale office air, she glanced around. Her desk was a shambles. Boyd's, as neat as a TV chef's kitchen. Not an ounce of flour anywhere. Well, not a file or a pen out of place. Clear sign of OCD.
Neat freak, Lottie muttered under her breath.
Because of the ongoing renovations, she shared an office with 3 other detectives, Mark Boyd, Maria Lynch, and Larry Kirby. Landlines, mobile phones, photocopier, clanking oil heaters, and the trooping through of every guard who needed to use the toilet gave the room an air of chaos. She missed her own space, where the silence allowed her to think. The sooner the work on the station was finished, the better.
At least the place was buzzing, she thought as she sat down at her desk. It was as if the events in the cathedral had stripped away layers of fatigue and boredom, revealing men and women ready for action.
Good.
Find out who she is, Lottie instructed Boyd. The Vic?
No, the Pope. Yes, the victim.
She hated when he used CSI language. Boyd smiled to himself. She knew he was gaining the upper hand.
I suppose you already know who she is.
She moved her files from one side of her desk to the other, looking for her keyboard.
Susan Sullivan, age 51, single, lives alone in Park Green, 10 minutes drive from here, depending on traffic, about half an hour walk. Worked in the county council for the last 2 years, planning department. Senior executive officer, whatever that means, transferred here from Dublin.
How did you find out so quickly? McGlynn discovered her name tipexed on the back of her iPod.
So?
I googled her.
Got information on the council website and checked the register of electors for her address. Was she carrying a mobile phone? Lotta continued searching her desk. She could do with a map and a compass to find things.
Nope,
Boyd said. Sent Kirby and Lynch to search her home. One of our first priorities is to find her phone and anyone who can verify her movements today. She discovered her Wi-Fi keyboard on top of the bin at her feet.
Right, he said.
Any next of kin?
Doesn't appear to be married. I'll have to dig further to find out if she has any living parents or any other family.
She logged onto her computer. While she felt excited, Lottie silently cursed all the activity the investigation would generate. They had plenty of work to keep them busy. Court cases dragging on, a traveller feud, and New Year's Eve tomorrow would bring its usual late-night trouble. She thought of her family. Her 3 teenagers, home alone, again. Maybe she should ring them to make sure they were okay. Shit. She needed to do grocery shopping and noted it in her phone app. She was starving. Rummaging in her overflowing drawer, she found a packet of out-of-date biscuits and offered them to Boyd. He refused her offer. She munched a biscuit and typed up her initial interview with Mrs. Gavin and Father Burke.
Do you have to eat with your mouth open?
Boyd asked.
Boyd?
Lottie said.
What? Shut up!
She stuffed another biscuit into her mouth and chewed loudly.
For Christ's sake!
Boyd said.
Inspector Parker, my office!
Lottie involuntarily jumped at the sound of the Superintendent Corrigan's thunderous voice. Even Boyd looked up when the door banged, rattling the lid on the photocopier.
What the hell?
Straightening her top, she pulled a sleeve over her thermal vest cuff and banished biscuit crumbs from her jeans. She flicked a flyaway strand of hair behind her ear and followed her boss through an obstacle course of ladders and paint cans. Health and safety would have a field day, but there really was little complaint. Anything was better than the old offices. She closed the door behind her. His office was the first to be renovated. She smelled the newness of the furniture and the whiff of fresh paint.
Sit,
he commanded.
She did.
Lottie looked at 50-something-year-old Corrigan sitting behind his desk, stroking his whiskey nose. The paunch of his belly pressed into the timber. She remembered a time when he was trim and fit, bombarding everyone with healthy living ideas. That was before real life had overtaken him. He bent to sign a form, and she saw her reflection on his domed head.
What's going on out there?
He barked, looking up.
You're the boss. You should know, Lottie thought,
wondering if the man knew how to talk in a normal tone. Maybe loudness came with the job.
I don't understand, sir.
She wished she was still wearing her jacket, so as to bury her chin deep into its padding.
I don't understand, sir,
he mimicked.
You and bloody Boyd! Can you not be civil to each other for 5 minutes? This case will soon be an official murder investigation, and you two are snapping at each other like feckin' 5-year-olds.
You haven't heard the half of it. Lottie wondered if Corrigan would be shocked if he knew the truth.
I thought we were being very civil to each other.
Bury the proverbial hatchet and get on with the job. What have you got so far?
We've established the victim's name, address and place of work. We're trying to find out if she has any next of kin.
And?
She worked with the county council. Detective Kirby and Lynch are cordoning off her house until the Soccos get there. He continued to look at her. She sighed. That's it, sir. When I organise the incident room, I'll head down to the council offices to try and paint a picture of the victim.
I don't want any feckin' painted pictures, he roared. I want this solved, quickly. I have to do an interview in an hour with Cahill feckin' Moroney from RTE Television. And you want to paint a feckin' picture?
Returning Corrigan's glare, Lottie masked her true emotions with an impassive glaze, an expression she'd mastered after 24 years in the force.
Set up an incident room. Establish your team. Assign someone to the jobs book and email me the details. Call a team conference early tomorrow and I'll attend.
6 o'clock in the morning?
He nodded.
And when you learn anything, let me know first. Go on, Inspector, get cracking.
She did. An hour later, Lottie was satisfied everyone knew what they had to do. The foot soldiers commenced door-to-door inquiries. Progress. Time to find out more about Susan Sullivan. She escaped into the pelting snow. Chapter 4 The County Council administration offices, housed in a new state-of-the-art building in the centre of Ragmullen, were a 5-minute walk from the station. Today, it took Lottie 10 minutes on the icy footpaths. She surveyed the large glass construction. It was like a monster aquarium with a shoal of fish inside. Glancing up the 3 floors, she could see people sitting at their desks and others walking up and down corridors, floating around in their glass bowl. She supposed this was what the government meant by transparency in the public sector. She entered through swing doors into the relative interior warmth. The receptionist chatted away on the phone. Lottie didn't know who to ask for, or if word had filtered in yet that Susan Sullivan was no longer in the land of the living. The young black-haired girl ended her conversation and smiled.
What can I do for you?
I'd like to speak to Miss Susan Sullivan's supervisor, please. Lottie returned the smile without feeling it.
That'd be Mr. James Brown. Can I say who's looking for him?
Detective Inspector Lottie Parker. She produced her ID card. Obviously, it was a slow news day in the council. They appeared not to have heard about Sullivan's fate. The girl made a call and directed Lottie to the lift.
3rd floor. Mr. Brown will meet you at the door.
James Brown did not look anything like his American soul singer namesake. 1, the singer died in 2006, and 2, he was black. This James Brown was very much alive, pale-faced, with slicked back red hair matching his red tie. His suit was an immaculate pinstripe, and he was short, about 5'3" by Lottie's estimate. She introduced herself and held out her hand. Brown thrust his small hand into hers, a strong shake. He guided her into his office and pulled out a chair from behind a round desk. They sat.
What can I do for you, Inspector? He asked.
Was this council speak for why the hell are you interrupting my busy schedule? He had a smile plastered over a stressed face.
I'd like to ask you some questions about Susan Sullivan.
His only response was a raised eyebrow and a flush of red up one cheek settling beneath his eye.
Was she due into work today? Lottie asked.
Brown consulted an iPad on his desk.
What is this about, Inspector?
He asked, tapping an icon. Lottie said nothing.
She's been on annual leave since December 23rd, he said.
and not due back to work until January 3rd. May I ask what this is in connection with?
Brown's voice seemed tinged with panic.
Again, Lottie ignored his question. What does her job entail? She asked. A long-winded response revealed the deceased had managed planning applications, recommending them for approval or rejection.
The controversial files go to the county manager, he said.
Lottie consulted her notes. That would be Jerry Dunn.
Yes.
Do you know if she has any family or friends?
She has no family that I can recall, or from what I can see, Susan's best friend is Susan. She keeps to herself, doesn't mingle with the staff, eats alone in the canteen, doesn't socialise. She didn't even attend the Christmas staff party. If you don't mind me saying, she's odd. She'd be the first to admit it. However, she's excellent at her job.
Lottie noted Brown referred to Susan in the present tense. Time to break the bad news.
Susan Sullivan was found dead earlier today, she said, wondering what effect, if any, her next words would have on him. Under suspicious circumstances. Until the pathologist declared it, she couldn't publicly announce a murder. Brown blanched.
Dead? Susan? Oh my God. That's terrible. Terrible.
Beads of sweat pulsed on his forehead. His voice increased an octave, and his body trembled. Lottie hoped he wouldn't faint. She didn't want the trouble of lifting him up.
What happened? How did she die?
I'm unable to comment on that, I'm afraid. But do you have any reason to believe someone might want to harm Miss Sullivan?
What? No, of course not.
He twisted his hands together like stress balls. Can I talk to anyone here who knew Susan? Someone who could provide me with an insight into her life?
More than you're giving me, she wanted to add.
For some reason, she felt he was not being totally honest with her.
This is a shock. I can't think straight. Susan was a very private person. Perhaps you should talk to her PA, Bea Walsh.
Perhaps I should, said Lottie. Some colour had returned to Brown's cheeks. His voice had lowered and the shaking ceased. He began wiping his forehead back and forth with a white cotton handkerchief.
I'll talk to her now, said Lottie, if you can arrange it. Time is important, I'm sure you understand.
He stood.
I'll get her for you.
Thank you. I'll definitely need to talk to you again. In the meantime, this is my card with my contact details. If you think of anything I should be aware of.
Of course, Inspector.
If you could direct me, please, she said, waiting for him to lead the way. He walked along the corridor to another office, a mirror image of his own.
I'll get Bea. By the way, this is Susan's office.
When he was gone, Lottie sat at the desk. She looked around the office. It was like Boyd's, pristine. No file or paperclip out of place. Just a phone and computer on the desk. A flip-over calendar showed December 23rd, with the motto, "The acts of this life are the destiny of the next." She wondered if Susan was now reaping her destiny, based on what she had or hadn't done in her life. A bird-like woman, with the tear-stained face, walked in and smoothed down her navy button-through dress with quivering hands. Lottie indicated for her to sit.
I'm Bea Walsh, Miss Sullivan's PA. I can't believe she's gone. Mr. Brown told me the awful news. Miss Sullivan had so much work to do. I was only after tidying her office and organising her files today for her return. This is awful.
She started to cry. Lottie assumed the woman was near retirement age, early to mid-60s, a frail thing. Can you think of anyone who might want to harm Miss Sullivan?
I've no idea.
I'll need your help,
and the assistance of anyone you can point me to. I want to build up a profile of Miss Sullivan and her life, especially in recent times. People she met with, places she went, her hobbies, her loves. Any enemies or people upset by her? Lottie paused. Bea looked up expectantly. Can you help me? Lottie asked.
I'll do my best, Inspector, but I'm afraid I've very little information. She was a closed book, if you ask me. A lot of what I know is hearsay.
Lottie took some notes, though there wasn't much to write. She would have her work cut out trying to establish just who Susan Sullivan was, and more importantly, why she was killed and who did it. James Brown rubbed his brow, wiping away sweat pooled in the shallow wrinkles on his forehead. He couldn't believe Susan was dead. Reading behind the inspector's veiled words, he knew she had been murdered.
Oh my God, he said.
He'd always assumed Susan would be around forever, ready to pick up the pieces every time he crumbled under the weight of their shared past.
Susan,
he murmured to the walls. His eyes lost focus against the magnolia blandness, and he closed them. Was this Susan's untimely death because they'd begun to resurrect buried secrets? He tried to clear his mind. He had to protect himself, to put in motion the plan he concocted if something like this happened. He had prepared for something like this, but he didn't think Susan had. Astute enough to realize that he and Susan were dealing with conniving, dangerous people, he documented everything from the very start. Unlocking a drawer, he removed a thin folder. He put it in an envelope and wrote a note on the outside. Then he placed it all in a larger envelope, addressed and sealed it. He slipped it into the post basket. The recipient would know if it didn't need opening, and to send it back per instructions on the note. If it did, well then, he wouldn't know much about it, would he? He stemmed his panic and took out his mobile phone. There was nothing else he could do other than make the call. With trembling fingers, he tapped a number into his phone. He began to speak, his voice strong and forceful, belying the tormented heart bursting inside his chest. Even as he spoke, the memories refused to lie down. He said, "We need to meet." 1971. The mass servers were changing back into their own clothes when the tall man with the thick black hair and angry face walked into the room. The smallest boy had the fairest skin and lightest hair, a whippet on two legs. He looked up wide-eyed, as if to say, "Please don't be looking at me," and pulled his threadbare jumper over a creased, once white shirt, now faded grey, buttoned up to the neck. A bony hand, veins protruding, pointed at him.
"You."
The boy felt his 8-year-old body fold into itself. His bottom lip quivered.
"You. Come into the sacristy. I have work for you."
But I have to get back," he stammered. "Sister will be looking for me."
The boy's eyes widened and salty tears curled at the corner of his fair lashes. Fear expanded into his heart, and the man seemed to grow in size before him. Through a watery haze he saw a long finger curling, calling him. He remained rigid, one shoe on and the other underneath the bench behind him. His beige socks creased around his ankles. Their elastic, melted from too much washing, protruded like little white sticks in sand. The man moved, and with a single stride his shadow fell on the boy, shrouding his body in darkness. A hand pinched his arm and dragged him through the wooden door. He silently pleaded with his eyes for the other boys to help, but they gathered their remaining clothes in trembling arms and fled. Golden angels adorned the corners of the ceiling as if they had flown up there, become trapped, and were unable to come down again. White alabaster gargoyles were interspersed with the angelic cherubs, their faces tired and drained. The boy tried to hide behind a high mahogany table in the middle of the room. The dark wood seemed to him to exude a deep, penetrating air of oppression.
"What have we here? A scaredy cat? Are you a little girl, you whiny good-for-nothing?"
the man shouted through his pale pink lips. The boy knew no one would hear or come running to help. He had been here before. A rack of black cassocks swung in a swish of air as the man passed by to sit in a corner chair. The boy shivered violently as the adult's eyes appraised him, like a farmer at market assessing a prize bull.
"Come here."
The boy didn't move.
"Come here, I said."
He had no option. He walked forward, his feet heel to toe like a tightrope walker, limping slightly in his one shoe. The boy screamed as he was pulled beneath two bare knees. Hands gripped him as robes were flung back.
"Shut up! You are going to be a goody one-shoe boy and do what I want!"
"Please don't hurt me," the boy whimpered, tears streaming down his cheeks. He couldn't see. He was so close to the darkness. His head was thrust into a gaping void and he began to gag. Terror grappled with his breakfast of watery eggs in the bottommost pit of his belly. It rose like a tidal wave and exploded in a vomit of projectile yellow phlegm. The man jumped up, still holding him by the hair, and hit him with a thump to his ribcage, propelling him through the rack of swinging blackness. The boy slid down the far wall, a limp piece of flesh, bewildered and terrified. He couldn't hear the names he was being called, as the blows came hard and fast against the side of his head, thickening the rims of his ears. He cried louder, his sobs thunderous. Then he soiled himself. And the angels sank deeper into the recesses of the alabaster ceiling as if they too were terrified. Chapter 5. Caffrey's pub on Jail Street was 200 metres from the council offices. Lottie was drinking thick soup with lumps of chicken and potatoes soaking in it, warming her from her toes up. Boyd was halfway through massacring a house special sandwich that would have fed two normal people. But he wasn't normal. He could eat anything, never putting on an ounce. "The skinny bollocks," thought Lottie. It was late afternoon and a few diehards who had braved the weather sat at the bar nursing their pints of Guinness and ticking off horses on crumpled newspapers. A widescreen television on the wall, sound muted, presented the races from England. No snow there. "Bea Walsh says Susan could have been a lesbian," Lottie said.
"Ever tried it on with the woman yourself?" Boyd asked, unaware of the coleslaw stuck to his upper lip, forming a makeshift moustache.
"I wish. Then maybe I wouldn't have this awful memory of being in your bed 6 months ago." "Ha, very funny," he said.
He wasn't laughing.
Lottie tried to dim the image of their drunken tryst. She hated to admit it, but she'd enjoyed the warmth of his body beside her that night, what she could remember of it. They'd never talked about it since.
"Seriously, though, Adam wouldn't want you to be alone," he said.
"You've no idea what Adam would have wanted, so shut up!"
Lottie knew she had raised her voice and was kicking herself for letting Boyd get to her. He shut up and continued eating his sandwich, muttering, "bitch," jokingly under his breath.
"Heard that," she said.
"You are meant to."
Anyway, Bea said it was more than likely canteen gossip, just because Susan was a loner. People love making up stories about the quiet ones.
"What does that mean? Like a non-practicing Catholic? Being there, done that, not for me anymore." "You know I'm not a lesbian, not even a non-practicing one. You're not practicing anything since Adam died.
Lottie knew Boyd regretted saying it, the minute the words were out of his mouth. She said nothing. Wouldn't please him with the sarcastic retort, even if she could have thought of anything smart enough to say. Either way, he was off the hook, for the moment. Nice soup, she said.
Changing the subject.
Boyd, Lottie said, I've related to you what Bea Walsh, Susan's PA, told me. As far as she knew, Susan was originally from Regmullen, spent years working in Dublin and returned here on a transfer 2 years ago. She also said no one could get close to her. She was a career woman, worked day and night, married to the job. She had to. In a man's world, to get to where she was. Bea's words, not mine.
But she must have had some sort of life outside of her job, said Boyd. Do you?
Do I what? Have a life outside of your job? Asked Lottie, finishing her soup.
Not really. Neither do you.
I rest my case.
You know what I mean.
Finish up your sandwich, Sherlock. We'll head to Park Green and see if Lynch and Kirby have found anything of interest in Sullivan's house.
Are you going to interview the head honcho in the council?
Who? Lottie asked.
The county manager.
Jerry Dunn's not available until tomorrow morning.
I take it you're not too impressed.
Take it any way you like.
Depends on who's given it.
Would you ever grow up? Lottie said. But Boyd was right. She was not impressed. They split the bill and left. They hurried up the street, leaning into each other, sheltering from the chill, their breaths rising and merging into one. Street lights reflected off the snow and ice, throwing yellow ochre shadows on the shop fronts. It was freezing. Bitter was the topical word of the day. Those foolish enough to venture outside scurried past, their faces snuggled into scarves and hats, shielding their skin from the stripping wind. Rushing along the slippery pavement with Boyd, Lottie felt the polar air pierce through her clothing. At the station, Boyd started the car. Lottie sat in, rubbing her bloodless fingers together.
Oh, put the heater on, she said. Don't start, he said, and took off, skidding dangerously close to the wall.
Just as well he had a badge, she thought. As he drove, she looked out at her town swathed in false purity, sinking into the evening darkness. Susan Sullivan had lived in a detached, three-bedroom house, situated in a secluded estate on the outskirts of the better end of town, if there was such a thing anymore. The area appeared quiet as they drove up. A few children, muffled against the weather, rode their Christmas bicycles up and down the frozen road, sneaking looks from under colourful hats at the two squad cars parked outside Sullivan's gate. A couple of uniformed Gardaí stood sentry. A car in the driveway was white with a week's worth of snow. Blue and white tape hanging loose on the front door screamed, "Keep out!" without actually having the words written on it. These were the only outward signals that something was wrong. Lottie felt like getting back in the car and going home. Detective Maria Lynch greeted them at the door. "Anything for us?" Lottie asked. She sometimes didn't know what to make of Maria Lynch, with her freckled nose, inquisitive eyes and long hair tied up childishly in a ponytail, always dressed smartly. She looked 18, but having served 15 years in the force, she was closer to 35. Enthusiastic without overdoing it. She was aware that Lynch was super ambitious, and Lottie had no intention of falling into the female rivalry trap. But she had to admit to a slight jealousy of the domestic stability her detective possessed. Lynch was married, she assumed happily. It was said her husband cooked, hoovered, brought their two children to school before he went to work and all that shite.
It's an absolute tip in there. I don't know how the woman survived in such a dump, Lynch said, wiping dust from her pressed navy trousers.
Lottie raised an eyebrow. That doesn't gel with the image I formed of her after seeing her office and the people she worked with. She stepped into the hallway with Boyd. The house felt crowded. Two soccos were busy, and Detective Kirby's